Antitrust relief valve is also decent.
That is decent.
Antitrust should be one word, I believe, but like no hyphen. But
what?
You know, we don't make these things up, Casey. it's not like we have a choice. It's not like it's an optional thing where from week to week we can choose whether to add or remove hyphens. We are telling you about a truth that exists. We are not making decisions on the fly.
That's fake news, John.
Yeah, we don't just insert hyphens like in the middle of words that are single words, like
or choose to remove them on our whim. It's like antitrust is a single word, and we didn't make that choice.
Let's do relief, RE-LIEF.
I wouldn't be surprised with you two. I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Oh, what we're telling you is that this is a world of information that is knowable, Casey. It is knowable to you.
So do I need a hyphen between relief and valve? You never know these days.
No, you can know. This is a thing that you can know.
Yeah, it's a syntax. It's very easy to understand the syntax.
There are fairly consistent guidelines, and through exposure, you should be learning about how they're used. There are always going to be edge cases that can be debated, but the basic rules you should be picking up by now.
Nope.
That's something I used to drive people crazy at work. One of the teams I was working with a couple of years ago, I constantly was trying to teach them the rules about hyphens. It's surprisingly hard to do. A, because they hate you for it, obviously. But B, they should still, even though they hate you, like many things you learn from your parents, you do eventually learn them. You may dislike the person who taught them to you, but you do eventually learn how to tie your shoes or whatever. Like you end up being able to tie your shoes, right? That is the end result. And ending up being able to use hyphens, my success rate is like slightly more than 50%.
Yeah, but I don't know if like the full immersion hyphen school is going to work for Casey. Actually, Casey, full immersion hyphen school. Where does the hyphens go?
It's between full and immersion, and knowing you two.
Why? Why is it between full and immersion?
Because you're specifying the kind of immersion.
No.
Well, I don't know.
Well, you're correct. At least this is step one. He's correct.
No, it's not the kind of immersion.
His reason, his explanation, and rationale is totally bogus. But he is correct about the hyphen. So we're making progress. Our full immersion hyphen school is working.
Never in a million years would I look at that phrase and think, "Oh, I need a hyphen between full and immersion." No way. I'm not saying you're wrong. For the record, I'm not saying you're wrong.
I'll explain it to you again, which we said in the past, but I'll explain it to you again so you can absorb it. It's when there's a multi-word phrase that acts as an adjective that describes some other thing. So there's a thing in there, and they're saying, what kind of thing is that? And to describe what kind of thing it is, there's multiple words that all combine to say, this. Mm-hmm. It's that kind of thing, right? What kind of preschool is in it? Is it? It's a full immersion preschool, but it's not a full immersion preschool. Full immersion is required to describe. It's not a full preschool, and it's not an immersion preschool, and it's not a full comma immersion preschool. It's not a big comma red bus or whatever. Like, full immersion, that multi-word phrase together describes the preschool. So full hyphen immersion. That's the basics before we go into when it's an adverb, you don't do a hyphen because you don't. Anyway, but like, yeah.
that's advanced course.
This is the basic rule we're trying to get through, right?
So many hyphens in these titles. Oh my goodness.
Anyway, antitrust doesn't have one, so that's just all one word.
There's no hyphens in this episode. I am stupefied.
And now we have a pre-show.
I'll don't put that in the pre-show, because then the actual people who know grammar are going to yell at me for my description.
Yell at you?
No, that's even better.
That's even better, is it? I don't think it is.
You think you're going to get more email than me about this?
You know, all the emails go to all three of us.
You are it's very easy to be successfully ignorant, but it's much more difficult to be successfully educational, right? Like, I tried to explain it, and they're like, well, actually, your explanation is wrong in this subtle way, and they're going to be right, and I'm going to have to endure that.
Oh my god, a humongous gust of wind just went by. I felt like the house is about to fall down. That's not good.
And there's no hyphenation in any of that. A humongous gust of wind is totally unhyphenated.
Oh god, here we go.
It's true.
Because it's just one word describing the gust of wind. It's just humongous. You don't have a multi-word phrase that is describing the wind.
It's not humongous hyphen gust hyphen of wind.
No, because what kind of gust of wind
is
it?
I'm kidding.
Single word.
Oh my god, I'm kidding.
You are kidding, but like, I want you to internalize this.
Oh god. Oh, I hate everything. I hate everyone. I quit. You're both fired.
So the thing I would do with the folks at work is whenever it came up is that the major thing that most people do is just don't acknowledge the existence of hyphens, so never use them. So normally someone would type something in Slack, which we were using then or whatever, and I would say, what kind of whatever? That was always my cue. You know, they'd say something about, you know, a file, and I would say, what kind of file?
You must be a joy to work with, John.
Right? So, and the thing is, I did this for like a year, and still a year into it, I would say, what kind of file? And they'd answer the question and be like, oh, it's like a text file. I'd be like, whenever I say that, it's because you used a multi-word phrase to describe the file, but didn't put hyphens in it. Like, I've done it 100 times, and still when I say it, I'd say, what kind of file? And they would just answer the question literally. So it's very difficult to get this to penetrate.
I'm glad that the John we have on the show...
There's only one.
...is the same John that exists at work, and that everyone around John is subjected to the same John.
Subjected is a harsh word. Gets to enjoy. How about that?
Gets to. Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, God. What is happening? What is happening? Do you hear weirdness?
No. Well, I mean, besides like our usual content.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, right. No, I'm hearing weirdness. I don't like it.
Oh,
I don't
come like on. It. Now what?
No, I don't know. I think I might.
What are you hearing?
That. I'm hearing like. Like that's weirdness. Yeah, I don't like
not
it.
Not a good sign.
Right. Oh, there it is. Okay. I'm just going to reboot. So please. Entertain everyone. Yeah, I'm just going to can all this. I will assume if you guys genuinely, if you just want to start the show, that's fine. I'll just pop in a second. But one way or another, I'll be back.
Can't start the show without you. You're the one who does the.
we wouldn't even know how to start the show.
Well, fair enough. Fair enough. All right. I was trying to be nice. All right. I'm hanging up now. Okay. Bye. I should note, and we can call this follow-up, and I guess just start the show. I have been adding things to my radar that I had put, or my feedback that I had put a link to in the last episode. I have been adding, spin dumps, tailspin, cyst diagnoses. I've probably got, this is not an exaggeration, I probably got like a gig to a gig and a half worth of cyst diagnoses and tailspins and whatnots on this feedback. And of course, as far as I'm concerned, I'm just barfing this into a black hole. I mean, I would not be any wiser if it was just going to dev null on some Apple server somewhere. But anyways, I have been adding all these things, I've taken videos with my phone of my god-awful refresh rate of my machine gun trackpad and attached it to this feedback. I've been a good citizen and doing what I can to get my problems fixed. And I have no idea if it's actually going to any human being, but that's okay. But one of the things I'm trying starting today is something that had been suggested, and I had actually tried myself with my old iMac, is not using Bluetooth for my peripherals for my keyboard and mouse, and instead plugging them in. So they're the, I don't know the official name for this, but the Apple extended key, not the, you know, extended keyboard 2 that Gruber likes, but whatever they call the Magic Keyboard with the 10 key, and then the Magic Trackpad, they're now both plugged in via, you know, lightning cables to my iMac. And that seems to make things a little better so far. I've also seemingly seen that a lot of network I/O in particular can really choke everything, which seems really not good, but that's the way it is, or at least that's some solid anecdata I've got for you, that, you know, if I'm running a time machine backup to the Synology while I'm doing something else on the Synology, while, you know, I'm trying to play a video from, I don't know, NPR Tiny Desk concerts, as I've been doing nonstop for the last few days, everything just gets real ugly real quick. So I have disabled Time Machine temporarily, crash plan. Oops, I rebooted, so it is running. I got to turn that back off. All sorts of things I have to do to get my computer to actually friggin' work. But no, Catalina's great, and I shouldn't complain about it.
Can we get a ruling on feedback versus radar? I know the app is called Feedback in this new purple app, and we don't use Radar Web anymore, right? But aren't they still just radars under the cover? Like referring to them as feedbacks or my feedback seems weird to me. I'm not sure I'm ready for it. Like, is it appropriate to be using that as a new proper noun? Are they actually called feedbacks, or are people just saying that because of the app name?
Yeah, I think like radar made sense as both the name of the app, also as the plural of like, oh, I filed some radars. Mm-hmm. I don't think feedback works in that way. You can't say I filed some feedbacks. Like that's,
I mean, you can,
yeah, but that's not a, like, the noun does not pluralize like that. It's, you know, because obviously the plural of feedback is feedback, but that's not how this works here. So like, yeah, it's just mechanically it doesn't work.
Well, let's just make an ATP ruling that it will be for now and forevermore radar. And
no, we don't want to be with the times. We wanna, you know, that's why I'm asking. I'm like, is it like internally? Because like internally, they had an app called Radar, and then what we were using was Radar Web or whatever, because we just got to use the web interface. We didn't see the native application, but that was ages ago. So now we have a new native app for regular people called Feedback. But given that the actual issues and numbers are all the same as they were in Radar, I'm assuming it's still just a different client for whatever is lurking behind Radar. Anyway, if some Apple person can let us know, are they still called Radars internally? Do RDAR URL schemes still work for people internally for Apple? Like, how should we be referring to them?
Yeah, like I said, I'm all in on calling it Radar and forevermore, as far as I'm concerned.
Don't get stuck in your ways, Casey. You're too young.
All right, let's move on. Let's get an update, John, if you don't mind, on Switch Glass and desktop backgrounds. What is your Vision Quest taking you? Where is your Vision Quest taking you these days?
Yeah, just a little quick follow-up on the big discussion last week about what I was doing for desktop images. After the podcast, I delved more into the code I had for copying the desktop window, and I got a bunch of suggestions for a bunch of helpful people on Twitter and through email that gave me a lot more confidence in the in my ability to identify which desktop belongs to which monitor by comparing the coordinates. There was just a y-axis flip. Like, this is the thing about the Mac. I guess in iOS it's probably easier and more consistent, but there are multiple different competing coordinate systems on the Mac, which is a little bit tricky, and I knew about that, and I usually account for it, but in this case, I was being fooled by the particular placement of my little sidecar display, my vast 6K display, into me thinking that this isn't a coordinate flip. I'm only off by like a little bit, but I was just like unlucky with the numbers. Like, so it looked to me as if it was like an off by 10 error, when really it was a complete coordinate system flip, and just because of the nature of how they were. Anyway, once I got that straightened out, and I'm like, oh, it's just y-axis flip. And then once I do the y-axis flip, I could positively identify all the things. So now I'm super confident in that system. And I think the window copy system is the way to go. That is my primary thing. I still have the fallbacks in there, but honestly, I expect the fallbacks never to be used, and I'll probably remove all that code. So that's what I shipped. I shipped the window copy code. It's out there right now. And I thank everyone for the help and clarification in figuring this out. I still think, obviously, there should be a sane API to get this, because it's apparently something that lots of developers want to do. If they ever show like a little miniature picture of your screen in like a preferences dialog or something, lots of apps do this during onboarding when they show like a little picture of your computer or a monitor or something. There should be an API that you just return an NS image. It should be an NS screen API called desktop image, or anyway, it's harder than it needs to be, but I'm glad I found a way to do it. And then as for Switch Glass itself, I am happy to say that thanks to all the people who listened to the show and bought a copy and then aren't using it, thank you, everybody. I have now fully funded the $400 aluminum bracket that holds hard drives for my Mac Pro, and it is sitting on my desk right now in its box.
Hey!
Although one of the things I didn't realize before I had an app on the App Store is exactly how long Apple takes to pay you anything. Mm-hmm. So in theory,
oh, yeah.
I have paid for it, but... yeah, the actual payment, according to the official party line at Apple, is after the end of the month in which you've had sales. So let's say January ends. You're like, when am I going to get paid for all those sales I made in January? Apple says you will get paid 45 days after the end of the month. Apparently, that is a little bit too pessimistic, and usually you get it around 30 days. But the point is, I still haven't received a penny for any of my apps, not even Front and Center, which was released a long time ago. So eventually, I will get the money to pay for this bracket, but I didn't wait to buy it. I bought it with the assumption that Apple will eventually pay. And of course, it came with that 8 terabyte hard drive, which I'm not sure what I'm going to do with. I'll probably stick it inside my Mac and see if I can tolerate the noise. But if I can't, we'll see.
Well, I'm glad that you have lent yourself some money in order to get this toy that you've been wanted but not wanted for so long. So congratulations. Marco, Andrew Larson would like to know, have you tried enabling high quality streaming? This is Andrew writing. I've always had this on and I've never heard what you're referring to. So this was with regard to Apple Music and hearing like crummy versions of songs. Is that correct? In the very beginning, that is, and then they'll get better.
Sort of. Yeah. So in AskETP last week, the question was like, you know, if it was like, if you could fix one little bug that you could fix in one day, what would it be? And mine was that, when I start streaming over cellular in the music app, every track begins with like a half second of very low bitrate audio that sounds awful. And then it like snaps to the higher bitrate, like responsibly, as it gets the connection. I said, just, you know, buffer it for a second and then play the higher one from the start, or, you know, preload it before you play it or whatever it is. And a bunch of people wrote in that basically say there's a setting under, I think it's under music cellular. Mm-hmm. And it's high quality streaming. And if you turn this setting on, this doesn't happen anymore. So it wasn't technically a bug. It was a bad default setting. So I turned this setting on, and it in one day, my bug got fixed. So how are you two doing on your one day bugs?
Not well. Not well at all. Oh, man, that's funny. All right, and then at some point last week, we were talking about the static analyzer in Xcode, and Aaron Farnham writes, and I don't know if this is true, but I have no reason to believe it isn't. Aaron writes that the static analyzer skips Swift files and only looks at C++, Objective-C, and Objective-C++, which is a bummer, but I can't say I am surprised.
That was the explanation for why I never saw any complaints in the static analyzer. Why is it? There's no issues with it. It's skipping all my files. Although I do technically have a couple of Objective-C files mixed in there, but they're small. But anyway, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, obviously the static analyzer was introduced back when, you know, before Swift existed, so that kind of makes sense. Why it doesn't work with Swift, it's kind of like Swift has the static analyzer built into the compiler, and that Swift is all about being able to reason about everything that's going to happen in your program and know, you know, that's what optionals are about. That's what its type system is about. It's not to say that Swift doesn't need a linter or a static analyzer, but I think Swift itself, the language, goes a long way towards catching the kinds of mistakes that you could, you know, that the Objective-C compiler will not complain. That's why you need the static analyzer or some kind of linter to yell at you for doing things that are potentially dangerous in Objective-C. But in Swift, the compiler's got your back for most things.
Indeed. Don Leibs writes, I was startled to hear Marco complain that the iOS music app loses its place in the navigation hierarchy because his own podcast player, Overcast, has the same feature. If relaunched in the background, Overcast forgets where it was navigated to in a smart playlist, I assume regular playlist 2. Similarly, if I navigate up one level and then back down to into the playlist, Overcast resets the view to the beginning of the list rather than what I was previously looking at. Marco, would you like to defend yourself? And let me state for the record, I was not the person who put this in the show notes. It's not my fault. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure. So this was, yeah, I was again complaining about in the same segment about the music app that it basically forgets everything about your navigation stack every time the app quits, which is very frequent. And so if you got to whatever you're now playing thing is by, say, going from a playlist or going browsing through somebody's albums and going to the albums, like it just loses all that and it launches you into like nothing. And by the way, iTunes is the same, or now music does the same thing. Every time we launch it, it's like, this is the first time it's ever been launched. It doesn't even remember what song you were playing. It certainly doesn't remember your spot in the song. So anyway, yes, Overcast does not remember your scroll position in those lists. It does, however, remember what screen you were on and in what mode. So basically, the way Overcast is structured data-wise, and you can see this on that root screen, there's a concept of playlist provider, and that can be either a playlist or a podcast in that root entry. And however you got to what you're playing is a playlist provider. So either you went to a playlist and picked an episode and hit play, so in which case the playlist itself is the playlist provider and the episode is the current episode, or you went to a specific podcast from the root screen, which then that is the playlist provider, and then the episode within that is your current episode. And Overcast always saves the current playlist provider and the current episode. So when you relaunch it from scratch, it will do that. It will resume back to where it was. However, this person is right. It does not record your scroll position within those lists. That's something that, frankly, I just hadn't considered that, like, you know, people would care about scroll position. But that, honestly, I just never really considered it. That's not a bad complaint, and I might implement that. And I'm doing all this manually. I actually, because I learned iOS development with the first SDK, which didn't have state restoration, it didn't have storyboards, it didn't have core data, like all that stuff. Like,
it didn't have backgrounding, did it?
No, of course not. No, right. But like the iOS 2.0 SDK didn't have a lot of critical stuff. Most notably, interface builder and core data. It also didn't have state restoration APIs, and so I actually didn't implement state restoration in any of my apps ever. I do it manually. Like, I don't, whatever the APIs are to do it, I'm not familiar with them at all. I've never used them, never even looked at them. I just do it manually. And in this case, I just save two bits of data, like the playlist provider ID and the current episode ID, and that's it.
I know there are a lot of state restoration APIs, and I believe they were introduced right before backgrounding became a thing, or maybe it was the same time. It doesn't really matter when. But my point is, they've been around for a long time, and I haven't looked at them in ages, but they are definitely a thing. Moving on, John, I'm assuming you put in the show notes the following: Microsoft Defender ...ATP?
Yeah, this is a Microsoft product. They have like an antivirus product. It's available for the Mac. There was some recent news that they're making it available for iOS too, which is slightly confusing because how the hell does antivirus work on iOS? But anyway, but it's called Microsoft Defender Advanced Threat Protection.
Ah,
it's
nice.
It's abbreviated by Microsoft as their product name as Microsoft Defender ATP for Mac, which I think is funny. this is in the category of antivirus or anti-malware products for the Mac that do not destroy your entire computer. A couple people have recommendations for things that are lighter weight and don't do giant scans and don't install kernel extensions that intercept all file I/O and network I/O and stuff like that. And apparently the Microsoft Defender series, both for Windows and for the Mac, have a reputation for being less terrible. And in general, I would recommend like virus anti-malware products from companies that are from very large companies or companies that sort of make the platform. Like I tend to trust more. Like if a company's sole purpose is to be antivirus, I have to think they are highly motivated to make the threat, you know, to take the threat very seriously and do everything in their power, because that's another check mark on their product. Like our product does this, does that, and the other thing. Whereas Microsoft is highly motivated not to make your PC bogged down because they get blamed for that because they're the platform vendor. Similarly, the antivirus things, anti-malware things that Apple has are so invisible that people think they're not even there. Even, you know, they are the X-Protect stuff and all the stuff they do to the file system behind the scenes. And obviously in Catalina, slightly more visible with all those dialog boxes asking you for permission. So antivirus stuff from platform owners, I tend to be more optimistic about. I still don't recommend anyone get any of these things, but I thought it was funny that Microsoft has a product that is generally well regarded and it's available for the Mac and soon iOS, and it's called ATP.
We are sponsored this week by ProClip USA, who makes awesome phone mounts for your car. We first heard about ProClip 2 years ago. A few listeners wrote in to tell us about them, and I bought one back then, and I tried it, and I'm still using it today. I love my ProClip USA mount for my car, for my phone, because I've tried a whole bunch of the, you know, kind of cheap, crappy, no-name ones, and they were all total garbage. The ProClip USA mount is rock solid. It doesn't budge. It's built well. It doesn't fall off. It's amazing. You know, you wouldn't think that like there's a whole bunch of room for quality in something as simple as a phone mount for your car, but trust me, there is. And ProClip USA is the one that you want. I'm so happy we have them as a sponsor. Here's what they say. Distracted driving is dangerous. We all know this. Our phones are one of the biggest causes of distracted driving related accidents. You need a safe and sturdy spot to place your phone for things like navigation, calling, and your favorite podcast, right? So ProClip USA specializes in high-quality, two-part phone mounts. Part number one is the vehicle base. This is designed specifically for the exact make and model and year of your car. You tell them exactly what car you have, and they have a base made specifically for it. So sometimes it snaps into the seams of dashboard panels, sometimes it clips onto a vent, whatever it is, whatever fits your car best, they have a mount for that. And there's no pro installation required. You don't have to like dismantle your dashboard or anything. It just takes, you know, usually 5 minutes to install these things. And then the device holder mounts to it. That's part two. And that's made specifically for whatever phone you have. So first you have the vehicle part, then you have the phone part. So whatever, you know, whether it's the very latest iPhone or Samsung phones or Google phones, they have clips for every kind of phone. You can choose from a number of different configurations, including custom fit for the bare device or adjustable fits for devices with cases, with or without charging built in. And then together, these two parts make the complete ProClip mounting solution. And it is rock solid, the highest quality phone mount I've ever seen. And this is like a quality of life improvement. You know, you never have to worry about it like falling off while you're driving or anything, which happened to me with all the other options out there. This is great. So quit tossing your phone into a cup holder. Find your ProClip solution today at ProClipUSA.com. And you can save 10% on your order using promo code ATP10 at checkout. So once again, ProClipUSA.com. Code ATP10 for 10% off your order. Thank you so much to ProClip for making awesome phone clips and for sponsoring our show.
Safari insert expiration. So starting in September, Safari will no longer accept HTTPS certificates older than roughly 13 months.
Not true.
Okay. Tell me what's true then.
You didn't do your homework. Did you read this article?
I read it very quickly about 30 seconds ago. Does that
count? Yeah. You're doing your homework while the teacher is collecting it?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I've done that.
I tried and true method. I know. That's why it's good to be. Sometimes it's good to be the back of the class, but if they pass the papers forward, it's good to be in the front. This is what I learned in school. How to most efficiently do homework 30 seconds before it's due. So yeah, if Safari just started rejecting certificates that are more than X amount old, like the web would break, right? So it's slightly more nuanced than that. They will like certificates that were issued before some upcoming cutoff date are grandfathered in. So if you just got a 5-year certificate yesterday, I don't even know if they make them 5 years anymore. But anyway, if you got a long-lived certificate yesterday, you're good. That Safari will not reject that certificate. But there's a point coming up or in the near future, if it hasn't already passed, if you get a cert after that point, then Safari will only consider it valid for like a year after the point you got it. So they're not breaking the entire web, but they are taking a unilateral stand to say, even though the rules about how long SSL certs can last, they're not even called SSL certs anymore, whatever. We're just going to call them that for the hell of it, like radars. Even though the rules about how long they can last don't say that they can only be a year old, Safari is going to use whatever market cloud it has, you know, significant market cloud on mobile, less so on desktop, to say our pretty popular browser is not going to accept your certificate if it was issued after, you know, whatever it is, September. I don't remember the date. I should look at the
September 1.
Yeah. And if it was issued after that and it's more than whatever a year old, we're going to reject it. Even though technically the certificate is still valid and Chrome will accept it and Firefox will accept it or whatever, we're going to say it's too old. And this is sort of Apple taking its ball and going home after losing the larger sort of committee argument of, should we make this a rule and we'll all just agree after this date, certificate authorities won't issue certificates that last longer than a year. And there wasn't consensus on that. So Apple's just doing it itself.
Yeah. Cool. This is one of those things like we think we have things like standards bodies or official committees or whatever else, but when you have a really powerful vendor, they can just choose when to ignore the standards bodies and do things themselves. Apple does this, Google does this, like there, you know, no one's hands are clean here. No one obeys the standards committees all the time. And that's just the reality of how the world works. So in this case, Apple is basically saying, well, we tried to make you all agree on this. You didn't. So we're going to do it anyway without your agreement. There's lots of reasons why having short lifetime SSL certificates is better than having long lifetime ones. I'm not really sure that this is worth it. And I know there's lots of arguments from the security people about, well, you know, if somebody compromises your certificate, then they can use it, and that's really bad. And it's like, okay, well, that's true. My two counter arguments for that would be, number one, they can now still use it for up to a year. Like, that's not that much. It's like, whatever time interval you pick, there's going to be the risk of somebody using a certificate within that time window. A year, instead of before, the longest cert you could get was, I think, 2 years recently. In the past, it used to be up to, I think, 5 years. But in the last couple of years, it's been hard to buy anything longer than, I think, 2 years. But anyway, that risk is still there, no matter what that duration is. It's an arbitrary number. And shortening it from 2 or 3 years down to 1 year, I mean, yeah, that helps, but that's still a massive risk. If you're going to say that certs get stolen all the time, then this is obviously a problem that can happen now within 1 year instead of within 2 or 3. And then secondly, this just adds more and more to the huge, annoying barrier of entry that the increasingly strict SSL requirements have brought to people who are just trying to run small websites. And I know that on a lot of levels, SSL is great, or whatever, TLS, whatever it is, HTTPS. Like, on a lot of levels, this is great, and we should be using it for a lot of things much of the time. I'm a little more on the side of, like, I think people like Dave Weiner who are like, we don't really actually need this for as much as it's being pushed on us. There's a whole lot of websites out there that are just like plain content sites that yes, there are advantages to them using HTTPS. There, you know, there's you know, proxies not being able to inject JavaScript like when you're on a plane or, you know, whatever, or crazy ISPs who inject JavaScript into unstructured pages. Like, there's stuff like that. And there's things like, you know, the way browsers treat HTTPS traffic a little bit differently with things like, you know, when refers are set or when cookies can be, you know, restricted and everything like that. So there are some technical advantages besides the encryption itself. But ultimately, for a lot of sites, they just don't care, and the people who are browsing them wouldn't care, and it's not that big of a deal. And the browsers react so aggressively now whenever you have something that's not super current or not using HTTPS at all. It'll say things like not secure in the address bar, which is kind of misleading when you're just going to like some blog and reading a blog post and it says not secure. That kind of suggests that you're getting compromised, but that's not really what's going on. Like, so anyway, the browsers and everything are so aggressive about this now. And everyone says, oh, it's easy, just, you know, everything that begins with it's easy, just is usually more complicated than that in practice. And the reality is you're now forcing every website owner out there to comply with increasingly strict requirements and mess with it increasingly frequently. And ultimately, like, a good solution is probably something like Let's Encrypt, which is a great idea of, you know, Let's Encrypt is basically this automated thing that you can set up. They are their own cert authority. They issue only 90-day long certs, and then the idea is it's so short that it forces you to automate the renewal. And that's a cool idea, and it's working for a lot of people. It doesn't work everywhere. There's a lot of context in which that can't fly, or that's very cumbersome and not really worth it. And so keep in mind that when the browser makers or whoever else ratchet up the security on this stuff, it just makes it harder and more cumbersome for sites to continue operation or to start a new site. Or it raises the barrier so high that it further entrenches the existing like massive hosting platforms or massive web hosts instead of making it so that smaller players can really stay competitive. And so there's all sorts of issues here that like every time they ratchet this up, it deals with this. And it's like a lot of the benefit of HTTPS, all that stuff about like, you know, not being able to be injected by your ISP and the way browsers treat it and everything, a whole lot of that has very little to do with the actual encryption being used and the actual strength of that and the actual, you know, lifetime and privacy and sophistication of the key being used to encrypt it and the method and everything. A lot of that is just because of the protocol and of the different ways it works. A lot of the benefit could be had with certificates that never expire. Like, you could just have literally non-expiring permanent certificates that would solve a lot of problems for use cases that where the data being transferred actually isn't all that sensitive. Things like, you know, my blog being hosted, you know, our website, like stuff like that. A lot of that stuff, you don't really need the encryption for encryption's sake. You know, you do it for other reasons or for less important reasons. You're not dealing with people's credit cards. You're not dealing with their personal data. You're not dealing with anything like that. So instead, what we have is everything's being ratcheted up so much that it's just causing a huge tax on everybody who runs websites, which these days is, by the way, pretty much everybody. It's like every business, tons of individuals. Like they're making it a giant pain, and I'm not sure the benefit is worth it or necessary for the majority of sites out there.
I feel like the other benefit to secure, you know, I'm gonna call it SSL again. I can't. I'm an old person. SSL is, you know, I know the thing of like secure versus insecure. It's like, well, this is just a blog. It's just, you know, who cares? There's nothing security sensitive here. Is the idea that the person on the receiving end has greater confidence that what they're seeing in their web browser is actually what was published by this website, like the authenticity, right? So if you just get HTTP, anything between you and them can completely replace the content, can replace the content of your blog with anything else, and it make people think that you wrote something that you didn't write, right? How can I be sure that the person who controls Marco.org actually serves this content versus it just being, you know, corrupted or replaced or, you know, whatever. And so that's part of the assurance, sort of the, you know, data integrity. What they are sending me is what I'm getting. Obviously, that itself is not hard and fast because there's all sorts of man-in-the-middle attacks that SSL is meant to prevent, but there are situations where things could be transparently re-encrypted and there's all sorts of hacks or whatever. But in general, having completely unencrypted traffic traveling between your web server and the people reading it means that anything in that flow can, you know, just modify the content easily. And the person on the receiving end has no idea, and the person on the sending end has no idea, right? That said, the sort of the pain in the butt for people is real. Like, when I first read this, I kind of groaned because this is my own fault, but my web hosting situation grew organically from its origins as I don't want to pay a lot for this web hosting, which is a good strategy when you have nothing on the web. But once you have more stuff on the web and you've just been adding like little pieces to that strategy, it's not great. So I've got many SSL certificates, many domain names, many virtual hosts, many, many everythings, all acquired piecemeal over, you know, long periods of time. And in recent years, I've been acquiring SSL certificates, sometimes because I've had to. For example, switchglass.app. I didn't know until I got that, and frontandcenter.app, and front-n-center.app. I didn't know that .apps, that domain requires SSL. If you have a .app domain, you literally cannot serve it over HTTP. Browsers will not go to it through HTTP. It's like built into client browsing software that certain subdomains are HTTPS only, and .app is one of them. So I was forced to get SSL certificates for those things. So that's a pain, and I'm dreading dealing with that because I'm bad at keeping track of these things. When do my certificates expire? Did I write it down? How do I renew them? Where did I buy them from? So on and so forth. So the countervailing force against all of this is things like Let's Encrypt. Right? So on the one hand, you've got pressure of saying long-lived certificates are bad for security. And as Marco rightly pointed out, a year is still pretty long, right? You know, any window of time is not great. Apparently, the system for revoking certificates is basically useless. So if someone compromises your key, there's not much you can do about it, which is why shorter lifetimes are better. But it's a pain for people who have websites. And on the flip side of that is, okay, so it's a pain for people who have websites. If we make it more and more painful by increments, hopefully something on the other side of this will say, we need a system that makes it easier. Like you were saying, Marco, about like Let's Encrypt doing 90 days. Like, we'll make it so short that you have to automate it because it's so painful if you don't automate it. And by the way, we'll make it free. So why are you paying for your SSL certs? Go to Let's Encrypt and they're free. Don't pay some company to do it. I see the tension between those two things. I want it to be easier. And for years and years, it hasn't gotten easier because there hasn't been a force on the other side saying, we're going to make it such a pain in your butt that you better make it easier or otherwise you're going to be screwed. In fact, one of the parties that in some of the articles that I read that doesn't want the certificate lifetime to be shrunk are the companies that sell you SSL certs. Because from their perspective, kind of like me with Switchglass, their ideal customer gives them a big wad of money, and then 5 years later gives them another big wad, and in between, you don't have to deal with them. Whereas if they have to give you a small amount of money every 90 days or deal with, you know, they don't want this. Like, every time there's a touch point between the customer and them, like their systems have to be more robust, they need to be more responsive, they need to deal with the customers more often. It's much better to get a bunch of money and not hear from me in 5 years and then hear from me every 30 days or whatever, right? And, you know, their systems are designed to vend certificates. Most people buy them for lasting a long time or whatever, and maybe they can't handle this. This is all just speculation. But in general, these big companies that give out certificates, you know, are just as ill-equipped to deal with a radical shortening of certificate lifetime as people who run websites are. In my particular case, I really wanted to use Let's Encrypt because who wants to pay? I wanted to, you know, I'd rather use Let's Encrypt than have it be free. But my hosting company does not support Let's Encrypt. It's one of the few companies that doesn't support it. Most of them do. They support their own thing. And I just wanted to click a bunch of buttons and give someone $10 and get a certificate. And, you know, it wasn't too painful, but because I did it through my hosting company that did it through this third party thing that shoved it into a shared host that has 57 virtual hosts that all have different certificates and domain names, all in different registrars, all different IP addresses and all the different mail routes. And it's confusing and it's difficult. All this is to say that I really want the tooling to be easier and cheaper and ideally free for everybody. And I think history has shown if there is no force on the other side making it painful, that will never happen. Like SSL certificates have been a pain in the butt for decades. Like on their own, they weren't getting easier. Let's Encrypt is the first effort to try to make them easier. And that, I don't know if that was a reaction to the shortening of the lifetime, but it took a long time to arrive. So while I'm dreading the potential pain that is in store for me personally for this, I'm hoping what it will do is put ever more pressure on all the different hosting companies and all the different, you know, people who sell certificates to make it ever easier to automate things, to follow in Let's Encrypt's footsteps, and anybody who doesn't support Let's Encrypt to start supporting it. Or if you don't want to support Let's Encrypt, support one of the other ones that charges you, but make it way easier to deal with. Because instead of it being something that people think about every 2 to 5 years, if it was something people had to think about every 30 days, it would have to be automated. Otherwise, you know, bad things would happen. And then the other thing that made me think about is, we hear about this all the time. I think it happened recently where, like, I think Microsoft Teams let one of their certs expire. Do you remember the news on that?
Mm-hmm.
We use Teams at work, so I think it was Teams. Every once in a while, you hear of some giant multi-bazillion-dollar company where, like, no one was watching the certificates, right? And all of a sudden, their entire application breaks, and everyone runs around like, what's wrong? What's happening? Are the servers down? I don't understand why people connect. And someone says, wait a second, our certificate's expired. Whose job was it to look at that? And it's like, I don't know. We got it 5 years ago. And the answer is, it's nobody's job. Like, this happens in big companies where if you do a thing and that thing is done and doesn't require any additional work, or even if it does require additional work, it's very attractive for management to take the people who did that job off of that task and put them onto something else. And so then nobody's looking at the certificates. Your job is to get a certificate for our new product. Good, I got a certificate. Okay, great. Now you're assigned to this team to do this other thing. And then maybe you leave the company, or maybe you go on to another project and forget about that. And then 5 years later, the cert expires and no one was watching it. And if that can happen to Microsoft with tons of money and tons of smart people, you bet it can happen just to an individual person with a blog or something. And it's definitely going to happen to me. I put a bunch of things in my calendar, I think, reminding me like 2 years from now, because I did get the longest certificates I could to renew the certificates. But by the time that event comes up, I'm going to be like, renew the certificates. What certificates was I talking about? And how did I get those? And I'll be going through my email receipts. What company did I get them from? Did I use Let's Encrypt for that one? Did I not? What was that company called? What domain is this for? So, yeah. And then finally, as for Apple being unilaterally doing this, it's a judgment call. Like, does Apple have the weight to do this? On the desktop, I would say no. On the desktop, I think today, the default answer for, certainly for any sort of enterprise thing, is Safari support on the desktop. Yeah, it's a nice to have, but if you don't have it, it's not a big deal. Safari mobile is obviously way more important just because they have bigger market share and bigger sort of money share. But there is the possibility that if Safari does too many things off on its own, they become a pariah. And people say, oh, we're not going to support Safari anymore because it's doing too many annoying things. Like, our website works fine in Chrome. It even works fine in Edge, but it doesn't work in Safari because it complains about our cert. Our cert doesn't expire for another year. Screw Safari. Right, it's a game of chicken to see who's going to win that one. And depending on who the vendor and who the customers are, Apple may lose that fight. But in general, especially on the iPhone, which is so incredibly popular, if an iPhone user can't load your web page and you try to blame Apple, that's not going to work. People who have the iPhone are going to say, it's an iPhone. Make your website work with the iPhone, and then you're just going to have to get a new cert. Like, that's how that's going to happen. So, I mean, at the very least, this is Apple trying to do the right thing. Like, it doesn't want these shortened certs because it helps it increase its revenue for ad tracking, or like, it doesn't help it sell more iPhones. It doesn't help it sell more Macs. It doesn't help it sell more Apple TV Plus subscriptions. Like, this does not help Apple's bottom line at all, really. They're just doing what they think is right, and they're basically potentially harming their own business to do it. So I give them kudos for having the guts to do that. I'm not entirely sure that it's going to work out as well as they think, but I can't think of any particularly nefarious motive for them doing it.
We are sponsored this week by Linode, my favorite web host. Go to linode.com/ATP to learn more. Whether you're working on a personal project or managing your entire enterprise infrastructure, Linode has the pricing, support, and scale you need to take your project to the next level. They have 11 data centers worldwide so far, including their newest one in Sydney, Australia, and they're always adding more. They have all feature enterprise-grade hardware, an S3-compatible storage option, and their next-generation 40-gigabit network. So all this delivers the performance you expect at a price that you don't. You can get started today on Linode with a $20 credit with code ATP2020. And Linode is awesome. I host all of Overcast there, all of Marker.org and personal projects there. It's just amazing. If you need servers, like, just try Linode, because I've tried so many of the web hosts in, you know, throughout my career, and I've been with Linode now for about almost 10 years, I think, because it's just such a great host. This is long before they were a sponsor, and I wanted them to be a sponsor so I could tell you all about this so often, that it's just, it's a great web host, and their pricing can't be beat. For this entire nearly decade I've been with them, they've been the best value in the business. And whenever technology gets better and they can offer more resources for less money, they do, and they give you like a little like one-click upgrade to upgrade all your current stuff to whatever the newest specs are. It's amazing at Linode. Their support is great, too, if you ever need it. And they serve all kinds of needs at all different levels. So their nano plan starts as low as $5 a month. And they have all sorts of plans above that, $10, $20, all the way up to whatever your needs might be. So, you know, including specialties like dedicated CPU plans, GPU compute plans, whatever specialties you might need, and whatever, you know, whatever your budget is, Linode has options for you. So go to linode.com/ATP to learn more and use promo code ATP2020 for new accounts, and you can get a $20 credit towards your next project. That could be 4 months free on that $5 a month plan. And with a 7-day money back guarantee, you have nothing to lose. So check it out today, linode.com/ATP. Also, they're hiring, if that interests you, go to linode.com/careers. Anyway, once again, linode.com/ATP, code ATP2020 for a $20 credit. Thank you so much to Linode, my favorite web host, for sponsoring our show and hosting all my stuff.
There was an interesting article from Mark Gurman in Bloomberg recently wherein Gurman is claiming that Apple is at least considering letting users switch some default iPhone apps to those of rivals. So they're considering apparently letting you set maybe Chrome or some other browser as the default. I don't even keep up with the alternative mail apps because it's silly to use one. And so whatever the alternative.
I used to think that until iOS 13. And now I'm like, am I the fool for sticking with the built-in one?
That's fair.
Well, why is it silly to use one? Isn't it just because you can't change the default? Is that why it's silly?
No, I was just snarking. But if since I've now dug this hole for myself, I'm going to have to try to dig it deeper. I mean, try to climb out. I think fighting the platform is silly. I also think that trying to staple on functionality that email just wasn't designed for, like snoozing and things like that, is also fairly silly.
It wasn't designed for? Are you like an email originalist? I mean, it wasn't designed for styled text either. Are you going to reject that? Do you view all your email in plain text? Then don't answer that question, because I know people who do that.
Oh my God. Why?
You know, the people use like Outlook in plain text mode and they send you everything and it comes through with like whatever your configured monospace font is, and they can't do like, yeah. Anyway, go on.
I didn't realize that you were bad cop this week. I'm sorry. Anyway, so point being that you can maybe change Safari to Chrome or something. You can change Mail to something else. And potentially you might even be able to use Spotify through your HomePod, which would be excellent. And it might even be the default through Siri. If you recall, I think it was iOS 13 that allowed you to say, you know, hey, Dingus, play the latest album from Mute Math using Spotify. And then it would actually, you know, pipe that through to Spotify, and that works reasonably well. So this is not being announced, obviously, because it wasn't even Apple that made this or that wrote this article. And furthermore, Gurman said they're just considering it. I don't see why not. Like, this sounds excellent to me. I'm assuming, as many others have, that this is because there's been a little bit of smoke around the thought of there being potential antitrust investigations into Apple for locking people into this stuff. But I don't know. Marco, what do you think about all this?
I think from a user point of view, this makes total sense. I mean, You know, Apple is never going to give up more control than they need to, ever, in anything. But sometimes they get pressured to in ways that are compelling, and they eventually just do it. And almost always, it actually works out better for everybody, including them. Usually, like, it makes their stuff better. It makes them sell more, you know, whatever it is. That, you know, and there's, you can look at tons of examples. Things like, obviously, like the old, you know, running iTunes on Windows to let people buy iPods who weren't Mac owners, stuff like that. But in general, iOS has, you know, obviously it started out from a very lockdown state. And in many ways, it still is very locked down. And Apple's apps still have lots of custom abilities that third-party apps can't do. But over time, with almost every version of iOS, Apple has somehow enabled third-party apps to integrate better with the OS or to have like a more first-class experience, to do things that previously only Apple apps could do, or to behave in ways that only Apple apps could behave. And over time, they've just kept knocking down those walls many, many times. And so from one point of view, you could see this as like, maybe they were going to eventually get to this anyway. They just hadn't gotten to it yet, you know, or that there were complexities behind this that they didn't want to deal with, so they put it off. But, you know, eventually it becomes more compelling as other factors, as you mentioned. Antitrust is, I think, a big one, which I'll get to in a second. But, you know, so over time, Apple does knock down these limitations, and they do allow third-party integrations in ways that we previously didn't think they ever would. And then every WWDC, we are like, oh my God, they're now letting apps do this thing. We never thought they'd let us do this. So it's a common pattern. This was noteworthy because it's been such a longstanding request ever since there were third-party apps, shortly after the App Store, when Apple relaxed the rule that said you can't make apps that replicate the built-in apps functionalities. Remember that when podcast apps were illegal for a little while? Yep.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still true. If you try to make a Springboard clone, they're going to reject that for sure.
Oh, right? Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Any kind of, like, you know, app launcher that contains other multiple apps, unless it's WeChat.
I
mean, but otherwise,
I was afraid I was going to get rejected for Switch Glass because it's like the dock.
Yeah. Same here with PikaView. I was expecting them to be like, no, just use Photos. Go away.
I think it still very rarely gets enforced in weird ways like that. But for the most part, that rule hasn't existed for a very long time, which is why we have things like podcast apps, notes apps. We literally didn't have those things for the first couple of years for that reason. Anyway, over time, you know, Apple has relaxed the system and allowed more third-party integrations at various different endpoints. And they've also pushed the iPad specifically into the Mac territory in a lot of different ways of how this thing can be used, what users need and want from it, what, you know, what degree of, quote, professional or power usage can be done with it. And a lot of that requires more Mac-like features to be adopted. So, you know, things like the Files app coming over, you know, to the iOS, to, you know, multiple windows and apps having multiple windows in the same app on the iPad, stuff like that. Like, they're slowly breaking down some of these walls. So for this, the rumor is they're going to allow you to set your own default mail app and browser, which the Mac has offered forever. Like, there's a preference in Safari and in Mail, and you can set your default mail app. And apps apparently have some API to call it, which is why every single time you launch Chrome for a long time after you install it, hey, you should set this as your default browser. And they're always, you know, fighting back and forth. And now apparently Safari shows a notification the first time you launch Chrome on Catalina, saying like, hey, you should try Safari, something like that. I don't know.
Oh,
it's
my goodness.
It's this glorious you know, eggplant waving match between those two companies. But anyway, so they've had this ability in the Mac forever of you can set your default browser to something else. In the same way that there's a system for file extensions and associating a file extension with a given app to be its default app when you double click files of that type, there's the same thing for URL schemes. And it's simply, you know, HTTP or HTTPS URL schemes will open the default browser, whatever that's set to. Mail to links will open the default mail app, whatever that's set to. On the phone, you have a few others. You have things like Tell to make phone calls. You have some messages things and a few others that are special. But anyway, iOS to date has not had a way to, first of all, if multiple apps can open the same file type or accept the same URL scheme, iOS has dealt with that very poorly so far. URL schemes, it doesn't deal with it at all. It actually just, you know, kind of picks one and just makes them all open in that, and you have no choice over it, and it won't let apps register for the ones like HTTP or Mail to let them do that. For file extensions, it has a system that's kind of wonky and kind of works sometimes. But anyway, for them to add the system to iOS to basically allow web browsers on iOS to register for the HTTP and HTTPS schemes, and to have some kind of UI somewhere in the system to choose which app that supports those schemes is going to be your default app. It's a big step because we've wanted it for so long, but that seems like it's right in line with that gradual progression of both Apple letting third-party apps integrate with the system more and more over time, and with Apple pushing the iPad to be more of a Mac replacement for more people. Because look at what else has come to the iPad recently. They recently brought over in the latest beta, they have the keyboard modifier keys panel. So now you can do what I've been doing forever on Macs. You can change the caps lock key to escape, which you could never do on the iPad before. Now you can do that because they brought over that little preference pane that's in the modifier key section of the keyboard preferences. That's now in the iOS beta. They are clearly making the iPad more and more Mac-like in feature set. Not like necessarily in the way it works, but like in feature set. They're bringing over like some pretty good like Mac-isms that help power users get their work done the way they want. So this could just be one of those things. And the combination of adding third-party capabilities and progressing iPadOS to be more of a Mac replacement totally could make this plausible on its own. But the antitrust angle, I think, is what is the driving force here that is making them go a little bit further or pushing them to do a thing that was probably not high on the priority list and is probably a pain in the butt in certain ways. And I think now the antitrust angle is getting substantial because Apple clearly has a problematic monopoly over software and purchases that happen on the iPhone because it is such a massive and important computing platform in the world. And so they have already had antitrust probes and investigations and claims in various countries. The EU has been pretty good about it so far. The US, of course, we don't have functioning antitrust anymore, so I don't think we would ever be a problem for them in the foreseeable future. But if our antitrust worked the way it should, we would.
If our government worked, it would be a good start.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's the larger problem. But anyway, countries that actually have functioning governments and that care about functioning markets are actually already opening probes. And Spotify's been very loud, and I believe they've been filing legal things in the EU and. I haven't been paying attention to the specifics of them, so forgive me if I'm misstating any of that. But anyway, the antitrust pressure is mounting on Apple from a number of angles. And to me, like I said in past episodes of the show, I think the two big escape valves that they have that they could pull, but they did. I'm sure they don't want to. One is sideloading apps to allow apps to be installed outside of the App Store. I don't think that's ever going to happen on iOS. Ever, ever, ever. I also, by the way, I don't think the Mac is ever going to go the other way. I don't think the Mac is ever going to go App Store only, because that would break things in a lot of other ways. But on iOS, I never see them enabling sideloading. I think for so many reasons, that's never going to happen. The other thing that would relieve a lot of antitrust pressure from them is to drop the requirement that all purchases that are done in apps use their in-app purchase system. To basically allow somebody like Amazon to build in ebook purchasing right in their Kindle app, or to allow Netflix to take your credit card information right in the Netflix app and sign up for their service without going through that purchase, without paying the 30%/15%. And that would relieve almost all the antitrust pressure that's on them. But that would also cost them a lot of money, and I don't think they're ever going to do that either. So I think they're looking for other ways that they could maybe relieve some of the antitrust pressure without doing the expensive thing. And by the way, Apple would be fine without that. Like whatever amount of money they would lose by enabling people like the big companies to not use in-app purchase. First of all, I think it's not that much money in the grand scheme of Apple. Second of all, I think the amount of money is going down over time as most of those companies give Apple the finger and just leave anyway and just don't accept purchases at all in their iOS apps anymore, which is an increasing, like YouTube is just doing that now. You can't buy YouTube Premium anymore or Red, whatever it's called this month. You can't buy that anymore as of, I think, March 1st. You can't do Netflix anymore. I don't know if you can still do HBO. Like so many of like the big top grossing in-app purchases by big companies have dropped Apple's system because it's just they're just losing too much money on the fees. So I actually think that the amount of money Apple would lose if they started allowing external purchase systems is not as big as it was a couple of years ago, and is probably not going to matter in the grand scheme of things. But Apple is really good at making money, and they're really stingy. And so they're not going to give this up without a major fight. So instead, they're probably looking for other antitrust relief valves that they can swallow, that they're willing to pull to reduce some of the complaining from people like Spotify and other, you know, powerful entities, maybe like Google for Chrome, you know. So they have a good reason to start looking for those handles to pull that are not the ones that will cost them money. That's probably a major driving force here. All that being said, I would like them to go slightly further than what this rumor suggests. This rumor is suggesting basically browser, mail, and music. I hope, and if not, if this isn't what they have planned, I suggest this. This should apply to anything that you can operate with a Siri context where multiple apps are supported. For me, one of the things I would definitely use it for is reminders. As I mentioned before on this show, I use the app Things. Great app. I almost always enter things into Things using Siri on my phone. And the syntax you have to use to do that, as you mentioned earlier with Spotify, you have to say something like, remind me at 10 o'clock in Things to do XYZ. And I would love to just not have to say in Things on every single invocation of that phrase. And so this infrastructure already exists for apps to expose their capabilities via intents, and they have classifications of, okay, this is a reminders thing, this is a notes thing, apps can say which of those things they can respond to, what kind of app they are. So the system already exists for Apple to make a preference pane somewhere in the settings app that says, all right, what's going to be your default reminders app? What's going to be your default notes app, etc. I think everything supported by Siri intents should have that ability as well, not just mail and web and music.
Yeah, the antitrust thing here is interesting because everything you said about especially about the in-app purchases and access to customers, like, and all the things with Spotify complaining and the EU, like, that pressure is real and is there. But this default app thing, although it's related, I still feel like it's the type of thing that Apple would have eventually done on its own anyway. Like, we've been talking about it for years, and it's always just been a question of when do you want to pay that cost? Because it's added complexity and it's weird. And in the beginning of the iPhone's life, it's not appropriate because you want to just establish, you know, the platform for what it is. And then in the middle, you're like, well, we could do it now. It wouldn't be a big deal, but we have more important things to do. And now I feel like we're kind of into the natural portion of iOS's lifetime when Apple would be looking at this anyway. Even though all that antitrust stuff is definitely a real thing and is surely influencing how they consider what they're doing to the platform, I think this stuff might have just, like, its time just might have come anyway. Maybe it was accelerated a little bit. It's so hard to tell because you don't know what's going on inside the company. But all that said, I think on iOS, on this speculation about iOS, but even on the Mac, the way Apple handles this now is not great. Like, you were staying it with an eye towards it working the way it does on like under the covers, like, oh, there's a URL scheme or a file type or whatever, and you have a thing where you map an application to it and you can choose from all the ones that can handle it. But that's not even how it's been on the Mac for ages. You just mentioned it before with a launching Chrome. Like, how do you change your default browser in macOS? Well, it's in Safari's preferences, and if you launch Chrome, you might get prompted, and Chrome will prompt you. Like, it's basically just a shouting match between the participants to say, over here, I'm over here, set me as a default. No, set me the default, right? And there are places where you can find this, like, it's buried or whatever, but I feel like doing it that way, just extending that system, hey, you know how you pick your default browser on the Mac? If you set it to a Mac user, they'll be like, no, I don't know that. Well, what if we extended that system that you don't know about already to everything? It's like, that's not attractive. There was a time in the past when this was a lot more straightforward and worked more or less the way Marco explained, which is there was a control panel where you could list. I mean, it was techie and nerdy, and that's the difficult part of it. But, like, I believe that Apple could overcome this. Here are all the protocols. Maybe you can't call them protocols. Here are all the use cases. And here is what you've chosen as your application to handle that by default, and here are all the other choices that you could choose from in a single place. I hate when they spread these things out. I don't want to go to each individual application's preferences and hunt in their individual preferences to find the thing that lets them, you know, retain or surrender their defaultness. And I don't want them yelling at me about make me the default. No, make me the default. There's a limited amount you can do to fix that. But if I could just go to a single preference pane and system preferences on the Mac and see all that information, that would be extremely helpful. Because there's more than just the protocols, you know, that you just listed. There's all sorts of weird secret things like the universal links or whatever, like on iOS, where if you go to twitter.com, what if I don't want to go to the Twitter app? What if I want to go to twitter.com? Is there one central place where I can control not only who controls this URL scheme, but also for universal links, whether I go to the web or to the application? That's not easily under user's control. Probably there's some technique, or when you go there, but then hold long, press on this and force it open in the browser. Like, there are ways to do this, but it's so Byzantine, right? So I think it could be way better on the Mac, and I hope what they do on iOS is not what they do on the Mac, because they're just repeating that problem. I hope they take both of them and say, imagine if all these settings could be in a single place. Because honestly, it's not that many settings. Like, start small, web browser, mail, you know, reminders, podcast app, like this, you know, they'd fit on a screen, right? And then for universal links, a section for anything that claims a universal link and say, should I use the app or should I use the web? Like, just something, anything. Like, it's not like Apple's afraid of having too many settings. Have you seen settings on a phone lately? There's a million of them, right? But it's, you know, just centralize them and make it more, that, you know, that was the promise of settings. It's like, oh, we won't have the settings in apps on iOS because there's not much room and it's a full screen thing or whatever. We'll put it all in the settings app, and then just things got spread everywhere. And on the Mac, I don't know why, honestly, they got rid of the old style internet config thing where you just had a single control panel where you set up all this stuff, but they did get rid of it and the system is worse. And there's all sorts of weird command line incantations that people try to deal with to change all this stuff. But it's like dark matter on both of these things. Why is my computing device that I ostensibly control acting in this way? Why does this app launch when I do this thing, right? Why does this go to an app instead of a web browser? How do I change my default app for this type of thing? It's, you know, it needs improvement, and it's not a super big technical hurdle. I think all the plumbing is there on both systems for all this stuff to work. It is just a fairly straightforward sort of UI task, a thing that Apple has done before on much weaker platforms with much, you know, more difficult technical hurdles. Surely they can make a preference pane and make a settings screen for some upcoming major versions of both iOS and macOS to let us do all these things.
I just want Spotify to be my default. Is that so terrible?
It's terrible for Apple's perspective as yeah, far as fair. Selling Apple Music subscriptions. Like, that's where I think the antitrust thing was. Apple doesn't want you to be able to use your HomePod for Spotify. There's no way in hell they want that.
But no. And Apple sure as hell also doesn't want Chrome to become a popular app on their iPhone, because they see how much browser market share they've lost on the desktop to it.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that people are talking about with this is, like, alternate browsers on iOS is pointless because Apple forces them all to use WebKit, which is yet another onerous restriction, arbitrary onerous restriction that Apple, you know, applied in the beginning some much better reasons, you know, like in terms of security and reliability. Now those reasons are less good, but still somewhat relevant given the nature of web technologies. Like, WebGL could own your phone, if, you know, whatever. But anyway, making Chrome your default is like, now you have a different candy color wrapping around the exact same browser engine that Safari is, which still Apple doesn't like it.
Well, but there's a lot more to a browser's functionality in today's world than the rendering engine. Like, there, you know, there's all the stuff about syncing your preferences and your tabs and all that. You know, the whole UI can be different.
And keeping track of what you do.
Yeah, like, oh, definitely keep track of it. Why do you think the world's biggest advertising company wants to do this?
Yeah. Or, like, just so you said, Safari rejects certificates that are issued after whatever date that are older than the year long, but Chrome doesn't. But yeah, like it's like you said before, why give up that control if you can't, if you don't have to? I've never found Chrome on iOS to be remotely tolerable. I still feel like Safari on iOS can probably still win on the merits in terms of what it's like as a user to use that application. On the desktop, you know, people have differing opinions. I run both all day long, and I actually like Chrome despite it being this weird mutant beast. On laptops, less. As we've talked about in the past, Chrome is a lot less desirable than Safari because it will eat your battery much more than Safari will.
And then now imagine that on the phone. Like imagine, you know, I know the reasons would be very different and it probably wouldn't be this way, but what if Chrome on the iPhone was a huge battery hog?
I mean, that's part of like that's part of what we're getting at is like if you let the apps compete on their merits, people can choose not to use Chrome because it eats your battery. Same way they choose not to use Chrome on their Macs, even, you know, over Safari laptops because it eats your battery. Like that's
right, but Apple Apple's point of view might be like, what if Chrome eats your battery and it becomes really popular on iOS because now it's a lot easier to use because it can be set as the default browser. And then instead of blaming Chrome, people blame their iPhones for having bad battery life.
Well, don't worry. Apple will pop up a dialogue that says, did you know Chrome's been eating your battery for the past 24 hours?
Try Safari. Like it's much more efficient.
Services. Are you sure you want to give this application location service always? Apple's gotten really good about nagging you about what other applications are doing that it thinks they shouldn't, even if you've already given it permission. Yeah. Anyway, the web browser one is fraught. Honestly, that one is, I think, the least important from my perspective anyway. The mail one kills me. I know Casey said it, he thinks who wants to use a third-party mail app or whatever, and about the nature of mail apps, trying to do things that mail wasn't designed to do, but forget about all that. Just sometimes you don't want to use a mail application because you like some other one better that does basically exactly the same thing. Nothing weird, no weird alternate interface to email and snoozing and different threading views. It's just like it basically works like mail does, but let's say better. like you don't have to go back to the inbox list and go back in again to see all your messages or whatever.
By the way, I have an update on that bug. That bug is still there in the 13.4 betas. However, I got somebody tipped me off. I forget who on Twitter. I'm sorry. But the messages that are missing. So the bug is like you're looking at your inbox view and new messages are actually arriving in your email account, but they're not showing up in the list. They actually are showing up. They show up at the very bottom of the list. So it basically breaks the sorting, and so it thinks you're showing all your messages because like they're in the data list that's being shown on screen. But if you don't scroll all the way down to the bottom of your inbox, which most people don't, if it's more than a couple screens long, you're not seeing the new messages a lot of times. And you have to go back and then go back in. So like they're there, but they're in the wrong place, which makes me think that this is a really, you know, possibly tricky bug, maybe with like Combine or whatever the UI diffable data source thing is.
Maybe it's a UI choice to not make the screen reshuffle when you're staring at it. Maybe it's intentional.
I don't know. But I bet like iOS 13 added a whole bunch of stuff about like diffable data sources and having table views be able to like insert stuff dynamically automatically based on responses in the data model and everything. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing that there's a bug somewhere in that or the way it's being used here that is resulting in this. And that's why it's been in every single iOS 13 version of Mail.
Yeah, probably. But yeah, like the thing about Mail applications is like if you don't... I don't know. Maybe it's not as bad, but like I feel like it is. Because web browsers, I know you can have bookmarks and all sorts of other stuff, but in general, there's not lots of data there. They're mostly stateless. Whereas email, like if you configure a mail client with your email account, it's going to receive that email. And especially on iOS, depending on the app, you have limited control over how much it does, right? So on iOS, I don't ever want to use the mail app, but I am forced to have it both installed and configured with a working email address because anytime I tap any mail thing on my phone, it's going to launch mail. And if I don't have any email accounts configured, I can't send any mail, which means I have to configure at least one email account, which means it's going to be receiving that email, even though I'm never going to be looking there. And I have a lot of email and I have a limited control over how much of that email gets downloaded. So I really, really, really want to use something other than mail on my phone, just so I don't have to have this sort of stub email application that exists solely so I can send mail, but must also be configured to receive mail from one of my actual accounts. And I hate it so much, which is not the case in browsers. Like I have a second browser and I always wanted to use it. Yeah, it's a pain but like my browser isn't constantly downloading web pages or, you know, something like you don't need to configure it in a way. You can just have it installed.
Another valid reason I could think of, well, I shouldn't say valid as though I'm the arbiter of such things, but whatever. Another decent reason I can think of that you would want a different mail app is if you have some sort of like corporate situation where you have to use some blessed corporate app that only, you know, something like Outlook, although Outlook is reasonably standards compliant, if I remember right. But anyways, you know, something where it's Acme Co's proprietary mail app, and that's what you want to use on, say, your work phone, then that would make perfect sense to me. And that's one of a million different reasons why one would genuinely want to do a separate mail app, even if they don't do, like you said, the snoozing and all the weird stuff that's stapled on the side of email these days.
Well, the pessimistic take on this whole default app thing is like, is the flip side of the reasoning behind Apple having such control in the beginning. Like when the iPhone was first introduced, you know, it was obviously no third party apps, right? Like, but the product image, like, how is it received by customers? What is it that they see? It's entirely defined by Apple apps because they were the only apps on the platform. And even when third party apps started coming in, Apple was still very sensitive to the idea that if you get an iPhone, we Apple want to make sure that you have a good experience with the basics. So we're going to give you a web browser that we think is good, a mail client that we think is good, eventually a podcast app that we think is good, which wasn't really in the beginning. But anyway, like they're trying to define the experience, right? By saying, we'll give you, they're not the fanciest. Like the whole point is they're supposed to be simple and Apple quality, but good quality applications. Because we know most people, if they get a phone, they just want to start using it and it should work and it should be pleasing. We don't want like you to unbox your phone and then say, now I have to spend 10, you know, an hour wandering through the app store, the giant forest of applications, trying to find the one that is free or cheap that is well reviewed. Like I don't want to have to go shopping. I mean, I want to get the phone out and say, I can already browse the web. I can already send email. I can already read the news. I can already listen to podcasts. I can already, you know, like comes bundled with that stuff, and that it's important for that stuff both to be there and to be good. And in recent years, a lot of the complaints that we've had on the show and that other people have had is that Apple's first party applications, while not terrible, are no longer like the shining example of saying, this is how an insert whatever application should be made. I think Safari is great, right? That's one of their best examples. But the mail application, it has never been bad, but I don't think people look at it and say, boy, if you really want to see how to make an email client, look at Apple Mail. I haven't heard that in a long time, either on the desktop or on iOS. And even for podcasts, they made that really weird app with the reel-to-reel tape thing in the beginning, which was kind of a misfire, and it was entering into a market that already had some applications. Like, Apple is not clearly the leader, even in these sort of, you know, simple to use, like, I just want a basic app that does a basic thing. In many categories, third-party applications are clearly better in all ways than stuff that Apple offers, not just because they're more complicated and have tons of features and they're pro and expert, but even just within the same realm of simple applications that do a basic thing and understandable, there are many categories where Apple is not the leader. One way Apple could deal with that is double down and make their apps better, like they did with Notes. For a long time, Notes was just not a good Notes application, even for simple purposes. The new Notes is way better, also not being more complicated. It's not like the new Notes is overwhelming and people can't handle it. It's just a better Notes app, right? That's one path you can take to this, is if you don't want people to constantly complain about not allowing third-party apps, make sure all your apps keep up. Make sure every app has a Notes-like revival where maybe it falls behind a little bit, and maybe people are like, oh, I don't even want to use the default Notes app. It just, it's like, it's not bad, but it's not good. And just make it better, right? But that doesn't seem to be happening that quickly. And maybe, you know, that's potentially a waste of resources. The whole point of Apple having this rich ecosystem of these developers that they brag about all the time is that those people can make a really good reminders app like Things. And then it's not on Apple to also have a team internally that also makes the best reminders app in the world or whatever. Like if there's a million, you know, to-do lists and all those other things. Right, Apple should be investing in making a great web browser, and I think they continue to with Safari. But does Apple need to continue to invest and worry about reminders being great? They just did this big reminders revision too, but I feel like they're always going to lag behind the really good third-party applications. So it's leaving money on the table for Apple not to say, when you get the phone, you will have good apps in all these categories, but also there are even better ones on the App Store that you can go, you know, buy or download. And it's really easy for you to say, I'm going to use that one instead. That makes people like their phones better, not worse. So they get the benefit of not having to go shopping, you know, getting something with batteries included that does all the stuff. But if they're interested in one particular thing, like I'm not really into these things, but I'm really into, you know, reminders or note-taking apps, they can just go and swap out that one component that they're interested in with one of the many third-party things that Apple has, like take advantage of their ecosystem, and they'll like their phones better. So that's the world that I would like to see, and I feel like Apple should have the courage to do that, both because they should have some confidence that on a level playing field, their good apps like Safari will compete pretty well, and also because they shouldn't be afraid of someone getting a thing and deciding they want to replace reminders with things. Like, that's good for Apple. They're not making any money on reminders. It has to be there and it has to be good. But if someone replaces it with things and they love their phone more, that's good for Apple too, because they'll buy another phone. So I really hope this rumor is true, and I really hope they do it and do it in a better way than the Mac is currently done.
We are sponsored this week by Indeed. When you start your hiring process, you may have questions like, will you find good applicants to choose from? What about education and experience? And how will you know you've made the right hire? Indeed is here to help. Millions of great candidates use Indeed every day to find their next opportunity. You can post a job there in minutes and use screener questions to help create your shortlist of applicants very quickly. Also, you can add skill tests to your job post so you can be confident in your applicants' abilities. Indeed's library of more than 50 skills tests ranges from industry-specific skills like accounting to general aptitude tests like critical thinking. Indeed gives you the smart tools to make hiring decisions quickly and to be confident that you're making the right hire for your team. Post your job today at Indeed.com/podcast and get a free sponsored job upgrade on your first posting. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and exclusions apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020. Thank you so much to Indeed for sponsoring our show.
All right, let's do some Ask ATP. And Stephen Gerstacker writes, now that the three of you have apps on the App Store, I'd be curious to hear how each of you handles the quote-unquote business side of the App Store. I'm in a similar situation to John, where I have a handful of apps that I ultimately wrote for myself, and I've made a very minimal amount of money from it. The App Store setup can be daunting, so I'd love to know how you guys set yourselves up from hobbyist development to full-blown self-employment development. I understand the words that are written here, but I'm not clear what Stephen is looking for. So, John, since he seems most interested in you, what did you do?
I think I talked about this when I talked about first getting Front and Center up, that there is a surprising amount of like forms that you have to click around through and things that you have to fill out. But in general, you know, I think just you don't need that much handholding. If you go to the Apple's web pages and you just go through all the screens and fill out all the things, you can get it to the point where Apple can successfully give you money. And if you're not making any real money, like I am, like I'm, you know, on applications that you just made for yourself or whatever, I think that's fine. Like you, as an individual person, I don't think there was anything I needed to do. You can just come off the street as an adult human, at least in the US, maybe it's different for in other countries, and go to Apple's website and sign up for a developer account and download Xcode and build an app and upload it and click around through many, many, many screens of things on Apple's website, and eventually you'll have an app on a store, and in theory, Apple will be able to pay you if you have a bank account of some kind that you could enter information for. That's what I'm doing because I'm not an app developer by trade. It is the most simple possible setup you can have. It's just me as an individual person and Apple, in theory, paying me as an individual person, and that's it. Obviously, the next step up would be someone like Casey and then Marco, even a farther step up, and then a step up from that would be a large company with multiple developers and multiple teams and multiple applications and so on and so forth. I don't know anything about them, but I'm here to say that if you just have a bunch of little apps you wrote yourself or are going to write yourself and you just want to sell them on the store, you can do that and you don't need anything else. You don't need a lawyer. You don't need to create a company. You don't need to have employees. You don't need to do, well, I don't know if you need to do weird tax stuff. I guess I'll find out, but I think it's other than some a few wrinkles about selling things in other countries. I'm hoping it's not going to be too intimidating. I guess I'll find out. But I think the barrier is actually pretty low. And I think if you are just a hobbyist doing it for fun and a little extra money, there's no real need to go farther than that. But, you know, I'm a beginner at this, so I obviously ask me again next year and maybe I'll eat all these words.
So I'm still not entirely clear what Stephen was after, but for what it's worth, for Fast Text, may it rest in peace, is doing this on, for PikaView and Vignette, I am using the LLC that I had set up for basically all of my then extracurriculars and now my life. And that was mostly unremarkable because I'd set up the LLC previously. You do need to get a Dun's number, a Dun and Bradstreet number, which I forget exactly what that involved, but I don't remember it being terribly bad. And I remember them really, really wanting me to pay them a whole pile of money to do something, and Marco and underscore saying, for the love of God, don't do it. So that was good. This is Dunn's, to be clear. Yep. This is Dunn's, not Apple. But I, Marco, perhaps when we get to your section, you can explain Dunn's. I'm still not entirely clear what the purpose it serves is, but nevertheless. But yeah, I am, or my LLC gets paid by Apple. Apple's relationship is with the LLC. And I am not a lawyer. This is not legal advice, but my very limited, mostly ignorant understanding is that if something went wrong somewhere, somehow, you know, I could, my LLC could be sued and all of the LLC's money could, you know, go up in smoke. But hypothetically, from a legal perspective, me, the person, and my family would be protected. And so that's part of the reason why I did it. Again, not legal advice. Don't trust me on this. Look it up for yourself. This is obviously very, very, very different depending on where you live, but that's the way it, I have set mine up. And I think, I don't think it's that dissimilar from you, Marco, although maybe if you wanted to at least throw in a comment about when you choose to set up a new LLC and a new setup with Apple, because my understanding was a while ago, it was very, very difficult to sell an app and you had to basically sell an entire company in order to make it easier on the Apple side. Can you perhaps talk a little bit about that in addition to whatever else you'd like to add?
Yeah, on that point, they didn't have before. Now they have something called like an app transfer that you can do. And at least when that launched, it wouldn't work if you ever used certain entitlements, including iCloud or CloudKit or anything that used iCloud. So like you just couldn't transfer it then. I don't know if that's still true. I haven't listened to it recently. It might still be. But yeah, in general, it's a lot easier to sell an entire developer account to another company than to try to break an app out of your account and then give it to them. It used to be and probably still is possible to upload apps to the App Store using your personal Apple ID. Because of what I just said about how it's very hard to ever transfer an app out of a developer account, I don't recommend doing this because... Unless you truly are doing it just for like, you know, a pure hobby thing and you never expect to make significant money from it and your use case would never have anybody want to buy it, like want to buy the app from you, then fine, you know, then use your personal one. But otherwise, setting up a business one is probably the right move. I too use LLCs. I do pretty much everything under LLCs that's at all professional for the reasons Casey mentioned of, you know, legal protection and everything. As Casey also mentioned, we are not lawyers, and these things vary depending on where you are. So speak to a lawyer if you're concerned about liability protection. But yeah, that's how we do it. Yeah, that's it.
Should have told me that before I uploaded these lucrative apps under my personal Apple ID. What if I want to sell front and center? Now it's tied in the same account. It's not actually my personal Apple ID. It is a separate Apple ID, but both of them are in the same Apple ID. They'll have to buy them as a set.
Collect the whole set.
Billionaires, don't worry. I'll sell you both. The prices are very reasonable.
Oh, my goodness. Star Sasumi writes, what's the different consideration when shopping for a TV for a console, a monitor for a console, or a monitor for a gaming PC? I have no input on this, and I'm guessing that Marco may not either, so let's just cut straight to the chase. And John, what do you do here?
It used to be that there weren't, I mean, there were always some answers to this, but it wasn't that complicated. It was like, well, TVs, they're bigger and they do TV things. And generally you can't connect computers to them, and consoles connect to TVs, not computers. And computer monitors have a couple things to worry about, different kinds of flat panels or different kinds of CRTs back in the day. But it wasn't that complicated. Now it is much more complicated than it used to be, partly because every TV can also more or less double as a computer monitor. Every console can connect to your television or a computer monitor, like the convergence of monitor and TV thing, like to the point where at CES this year, TV makers were really pushing television sets essentially made to be gaming monitors, right? There's a major convergence going on here, but there are concerns that are different in each domain, even though the actual physical devices and software related to them, there has a huge amount of overlap. They are tailored for certain purposes. So these days, if you're looking for something that you're going to play a game on, there are some features that you're interested in that you don't care about if you're just going to watch TV on it. And those are the HDMI spec, the latest HDMI spec, and some of the ancillary things related to, what are they called? Adaptive frame rate, or God, I should have written these things down. There's a bunch of acronyms for things that let you change the frame rate from a moment to moment basis. And there's a bunch of standards for that related to the HDMI spec. There's some proprietary things, depending on what you're going to be connecting to it, like NVIDIA's G-Sync, which do similar things. There's auto low latency mode on televisions, which tries to detect that you have a console connected and goes into a mode where you have the lowest amount of input lag. Years ago, TV manufacturers didn't even know what input lag was. They didn't even list it in their specs. Nobody cared about it except for video gamers, and they would test it themselves using these light rigs. Nowadays, they're building in features for it. It used to be called game mode. Now it's auto low latency mode. What the hell is the frame rate thing called? Someone in the chat room could tell me. There's an acronym for it. Anyway, if you are gaming, care about those things. Look at the input lag. Look for auto latency mode. Look for variable refresh rate. That's another thing. Thank you, chat room. It's not what I was trying to think of. The variable refresh rate is the not just variable refresh rate, the actual refresh rate, right? So televisions used to only have to refresh at like some reasonable multiple of the frame rate of television and maybe movies, right? But video games, especially for hardcore gamers, like higher and higher refresh rates. It's no point in having 100 frames per second on your game if your screen is updating 60 times a second. That's just wasted, right? So gaming monitors and now televisions that support gaming applications have higher refresh rates. So don't get a television that has a maximum refresh rate of 60 hertz expecting to play 120 frames per second. It's pointless. You're not going to get any benefit. So if you're going to game on it, look for all those things. High refresh rate, variable refresh rate, auto latency mode, and then also all the things that we normally talk about. Picture quality, price, size, heat, fan noise, the whole nine yards, right? So it's more complicated than it used to be, but there are a bunch of things that you should look at that are only apply to games. If you're just going to watch TV on it, you actually do care about frame rate a little bit if you want to see those weird high frame rate movies at like 60 frames per second. But as far as I'm aware, there's not a lot of television or movie content at 144 frames per second. So you don't have to worry about that too much. A variable refresh rate is not really an important thing for video because most video content has a single refresh rate through the whole thing. And it certainly isn't changing from moment to moment. Although that's not entirely true. There are some things where it varies. And yeah, auto latency mode doesn't matter when there's no input. So there you go.
Finally, Future Ben writes, I've been tearing my hair out over this question for years. When to use a notes app like Apple Notes versus traditional files? For casual users, they may not be an issue, but the further down the rabbit hole you go, the more these paradigms compete with one another. For me, if I am writing something down or copying a URL or something along those lines, it goes into Apple Notes. And if it's like a PDF or something like that, it goes into the file system. And that's about it. Marco, how do you handle this?
I don't have a great system for this, honestly. Like, Notes is when I basically... Notes is like my scratch pad. And I do actually use it for, like, some long-term storage or some things, but I'm not very consistent about it. I'm using it more over time. This wasn't part of the question, but I do wish that Notes had a file system representation that was meaningful and that could be backed up and imported and exported. That is one thing, like, as I use Notes for more and more stuff, I am a little bit afraid of someday losing all my notes because of some iCloud mishap or some local whatever, and I don't know how to back it up, and I don't know how to restore it. And I think there are apps where you can, like, export your notes out in various formats, but I don't know of any kind of import after that, so I don't know. That makes me... The fact that Notes doesn't just store your notes in an easily parsed file system representation makes me a little bit uneasy.
John?
Yeah, Marco hit the major point that I wanted to hit, which is the decision point about this is, do you want to use and trust an app that owns a collection of data, whether it be Apple Notes or any other app that mediates the data store? Because once you do that, bugs in that app, changes in business models of that app, anything having to do with that app can get between you and your information. Whereas if you do it as individual files, especially if those are plain text files, it's more annoying and loosey-goosey and you lose some of the features, but you also don't have to worry about the app that controls them, even just changing in a way you don't like. Oh, I put all my life in insert app X, and then app X changed their user interface and now I hate it. Now you're like, well, that's all where all my data is. They have a good export functionality. Can I get it import? Like, there are good apps and bad apps for that. You're looking for an app that does have good exportability, ability to back up to a standard format, and maybe an import ability to go in the other direction. But you're worried about syncing bugs, you worry about business model changes, you worry about app UI changes, all that stuff. On a recent episode of Rectus, I was talking about exactly that thing with Notes. I'm putting an increasing amount of stuff in Notes too, and I was getting paranoid about backups. Merlin recommended this Notes exporter app. There's a couple of apps out there that do similar things where they will, I think they just use the AppleScript dictionary or something like that. They will go through all your notes and export each one as like a PDF or something, which is not great, but it's better than nothing. So I ran that to export all my notes. A lot of people tried to make shortcuts for it and other sort of automations. And apparently at a certain point, Notes just surrenders and stops exporting things. And I don't know if it's a bug with the automation or something like that, but it's been a challenge to do with shortcuts. But the Notes is an example of an application that I think is pretty solid and I haven't had any problems with it, but it does not have really good export and import functionality built into the app as far as I'm aware, which is why we're trying to use the third-party apps. So I kind of organically grew into Notes. That's the thing to watch for. If you decide I'm going to use an app and not a bunch of individual files because individual files are a pain in my butt and it's so much easier to just take up my phone and use Notes, that's an easy decision to make in the moment. And then fast forward 6 months and now you have substantial amount of valuable data in Notes and now you're worried about how to back it up. So happens to the best of us, but that I feel like is the distinction. It's trusting a sort of mediator and owner for the data versus you having to do all that stuff yourself.
Yeah, it's like Notes to me, it's like nuclear power. It's like
I can't wait for this analogy. Go ahead.
Chances are nothing will ever go wrong. And as long as nothing ever goes wrong, there's a lot of things to like about it. And you just hope nothing ever goes wrong, because if something goes wrong, it's going to go really wrong.
Does it produce waste that we have to dispose of in ways that we haven't figured out yet?
We're just going to put that question off to another time. Thanks to our sponsors this week, Linode, Indeed, and ProClip USA. And we'll talk to you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin. Because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him. Because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
I really, really did not want to downgrade this machine to Mojave. That this motherfucker is going getting Mojave tomorrow. Oh my god, I'm so
happened?
Angry. So all of a sudden the bzz, bzz came back, and I'm like, okay. And then all of a sudden you guys disappeared. Okay, but Audio Hijack is still counting. Skype is still counting. Everything's fine. And then I heard, and Skype said, oh, your microphone is screwed. Unplug it and try again. So, Marco, you're going to have a fun edit. I'm sorry. But I am putting it on record that if I am still on Catalina this time next week, please, somehow, send somebody to kick me square in the gentleman region, because this is intolerable and I can't stand it. And this is we got so much flack last week after I went on a tear about Catalina, and you know, somebody was saying, oh, why did you say it's unusable? Okay, here's why I think Catalina is unusable: because I am trying to do my job and I cannot, because things failed while I was trying to do my job. Is that a satisfactory enough reason for you, everyone? So this is getting Mojave tomorrow, and I am so cranky right now, and you're going to be cranky when you deal with my 400 files tomorrow. So, and that makes me cranky because I don't like making other people cranky.
And you're going to be cranky the first time you go to use Swift UI on Mojave after having it on Catalina.
You're going to be cranky when you revert to Swift UI, when you revert to Mojave and you still have these problems. Then what will we say?
And then AppleCare Plus becomes a thing, or whatever it's called on this. But yes,
I think some evil spirit has inhabited your computer room, at least, if not your whole house.
I hear you. I honestly hear you. And if I were in your shoes, I would say the same thing. But all I know is this machine was bulletproof on Mojave. And since I put Catalina on, because I'm a darn fool, everything has gotten worse. Everything has gotten worse.
Yeah, all signs point to that being the case. I hope your downgrade fixes everything.
Oh, God, I hope so, too. The only question is, do I use the super-duper backup that I took and have not modified right before I did the upgrade, or do I just throw everything away?
You're like hoteling in your own house. Like, you have no data. Know, like every night, someone could come and erase your whole computer, and you wouldn't notice, because you don't actually any data on
it. You're right. Which, in a lot of ways, and we talked about this a few weeks ago, in a lot of ways, I think that's a testament to, like, GitHub, and well, I don't use Dropbox anymore, but, you know, Dropbox and things like that, but... The good news from having to do this 84 times over the last few months is that I've become very, very good at it. And so it's a very streamlined operation. My dad, when he was, I think I might've been just born. He had a Plymouth Duster, if I remember correctly. And I forget what the issue ended up being. Like, something was misaligned, but they didn't know it for the longest time. I might've told this story as well, but, the house that we had lived in when I was freshly born, my dad had the house built. And in the garage, he actually had a pit. So, you know, you would drive the car onto like boards or planks, or I don't know, like maybe it was metal for all I know, but you would drive it on these pieces of metal, let's say, and then you could climb down under the car. So it's like, the inverse of a lift. And what had happened is he kept going through clutches in this duster. And my understanding or family legend tells me that that mom and dad could do an entire clutch in this car in like the span of 2 or 3 hours or something like that, like something absolutely preposterous, because they were doing it like once every 2 months or something like that. And they eventually figured out the problem and fixed it properly. But yeah, that's me with this darn computer. All kidding aside, I have what I thought to be a bulletproof super duper backup of Mojave sitting on a hard drive on my desk. Starting with Marco and then John, would you trust and use that and just plow what's currently on the machine, or would you just go for broke and install fresh?
I would maybe first boot it and see how it boots, and then maybe decide after that. Weird stuff would happen if you just went back in time and like you don't have any of your files. And like I don't know. I think that's a recipe for accidental data loss of stuff you've made in the meantime.
Well, I mean, the first thing I want to do is go through my list of places where I do store stuff. You know, I'm like, there are a handful of things on my desktop. There may be some things and downloads that I care about, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll back up my Plex, database and so on and so forth. All that stuff will happen before I even worry about, booting off of the super duper backup. But assuming that the super duper backup boots reasonably well, do you think you would use it? But, take it and put it onto the machine.
I mean, how old is it at this point?
It's 3 weeks, a month.
That's too far back. I mean, I store actual data. I would never, that's too far back for me. I would be missing too much stuff, and I have no way to sort of, diff it. I don't know. If I actually had to downgrade my machine, which obviously I can't, but if I had to, I would install Mojave on top of Catalina. I know that's not what you want to do, especially if you want to eliminate the source of weird errors, but you're into the hoteling lifestyle anyway. You should just wipe this machine and put a fresh... if you think you actually know how to save your data, do that. Yeah. I would suggest making a full clone and setting that aside. So then, if you just remembered, oh, by the way, I was also keeping something in this obscure directory. You've got right? Yeah. Do that and wipe the whole machine and Mojave from scratch. Like wipe as in repartition, as in get rid of all of Catalina, the whole nine yards, go to the actual partition level, not the APFS container level, but the actual GPT partition level, and then get rid of all that stuff.
No, yeah, I think you probably convinced me, first of all, that I'll do a super duper of this one just for safety's sake, and then I'll go into internet recovery, delete everything on this hard drive, to your point, and then start fresh with Mojave.
I'm just a super duper. Also, get caught up on Time Machine. You need to have all your data in two places before you erase it from your computer, at least two places.
That's fair. But anyway, I promise, gentlemen, that by this time next week, I will no longer be on Catalina, because this is driving me absolutely batty. And I do love dark mode. I really do, in the dark, when it's evening, that is. I do love dark mode, and I do love having that sweet, sweet SwiftUI preview, but it is just not worth it. It is not worth it. Not for me.
I wonder, what's your long-term game plan here?
I honestly don't know.
Catalina. He's going to...
Yeah, either skip Catalina or perhaps wait another few point releases and see what happens. You know, like, what is it right now? It's...
what are you going to use to gauge whether it's safe to upload to 10.15.5, 10.15.6? Because...
I don't know.
I mean, this is why, like, I've never downgraded like this before because my strategy is basically, like, once I'm on, I don't go backwards. I only go, you know, I'm only on defense. Like, I only go forward because...
that's offense.
Whatever. Going back is, a big deal. It's hard and potentially destructive to certain things. And then, B, you're going to have to go forward again at some point anyway.
Yeah, but what do I do in the meantime, though? You know, like, this is unacceptable for me and for you.
Yeah, so I think the other answer is, like, there's lots of us who are doing podcasts on Catalina without this problem. So Catalina is probably not the problem. There maybe something is being worse on Catalina. Maybe it's a coincidence of timing. Who knows? But, like, I'm podcasting on Catalina using the same USB device that you're using.
Well, I did last week and it was fine.
Yeah, you did last week and it was fine. So obviously, like, it is possible to use Catalina without having the specific problems you're having right now. So the OS version itself is probably not the problem. It may have exacerbated things. It may have brought things to the foreground, or it may just be a coincidence. So I would start investigating other potential explanations and solutions. So,
like, things, what though?
So, you know, things like changing out the trackpad for a trackpad that, like, it's just swapping it out. Like, don't you have two?
I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just try the other one. Do you use it in wired mode?
I actually am tonight. That's the first time. Which, okay, so to that end.
Unplug it.
Well, no. Problem but solved. Here's the thing. Well, maybe. Maybe you're right. Or at the very least, unplug it when I'm podcasting. That's actually a very interesting point. But the reason it got plugged in the first place was because of all the issues I was having, you know, with, like, really bad latency and the machine gun trackpad and all that. So it seems like my choices are use it on Bluetooth, where I've got machine gun trackpad and really bad pointer latency, or use it when it's plugged in and potentially have some sort of issue with my microphone. So I guess the answer is I unplug when I record and plug in when I'm not recording. But, like, this shouldn't be a problem.
Do you have any other stuff connected to your computer? Like, that's the usual dance you do, is, like, start removing, disconnecting everything from your computer until it is just the computer by itself with nothing connected to it, and then you connect a keyboard, and then you try it, and it's okay, and then you connect a pointing device. Like, do you have anything else? Do you have any external drives? Do you have an Ethernet cable? Like,
presently plugged in? I mean, like, I have a bunch of things that are hanging, like, a bunch of USB cords that aren't connected to anything right now. So as an example, like, I have a cord connected to my computer that I could plug into an external hard drive, but it's not presently plugged into an external hard drive.
Yeah, that's probably not it, but I would unplug those anyway. Just, you know, it's typical troubleshooting. Like, remove all variables. Try to figure out what the hell is the problem with the thing. Like, with that staticky thing, like, maybe it was the simulator. Maybe it was just a simulator hangover, and maybe the only way to cure that it was a reboot.
No, but I rebooted afterwards. I did reboot. That's
and
the thing.
And then you got it again. I mean, yeah. maybe your audio box is fritzing. Who knows? Like,
what about, like, you know, there's possible other explanations, like, or other things to try, like, making sure that the audio interface and the trackpad are not sharing a USB bus. I don't know how you can do that. Maybe certain ports are different buses. Maybe you can put the trackpad on a hub and not put the audio interface on a hub. Like, put the audio interface directly into one of the ports in the back, and then put the trackpad interface on, or put the trackpad on its own hub or something. Or, like, use one of the USB-A ports for the trackpad and use a USB-C port for the audio interface using a C to B cable. Like, there's options like that. That's what I do, honestly. I do the C to B cable thing. You know, ways to just try to separate this device that you think is possibly causing you problems, which is the trackpad, from things that are critical to work for your job, like the audio interface. You know, have it be two separate parts of the computer. Like, I you can probably look up somewhere. Like, I bet certain port pairs or sets are on certain USB buses. It probably isn't all one bus. It's probably, like, you know, two or three different controllers in there. So I would try that. Because, like, USB is a weird protocol with weird devices that flake out sometimes, and, like, one bad USB device can wreak havoc on a system. So the more you can do to, like, try to isolate it or try to swap out the trackpad for a different one and see if that works, you know, trying that first is easier and probably more likely to work than changing your entire OS version.
Yeah, I feel like I want the nuclear option, but the two of you are convincing me that maybe I'm getting a little aggressive.
But if you didn't have this problem with Mojave, it really is quite a timing coincidence. It could be like some bad behavior that, unless you did actually move things to different ports or connect new things, but it could just be some bad behavior that Mojave handles differently than Catalina. So downgrading may actually solve the problem without actually letting you know what it was. Like, the problem might be some chatty USB thing, or the fact that you refuse to go into your own attic and get the trackpad out from the other computer.
All right, I super duper promise. Well, let me ask you, I'm not trying to snark. Would the two of you rather me try a different trackpad or go back to a mouse? Because I'm perfect. I don't have an issue with the mouse. I used the mouse up until literally like 6 months ago. So
I have so much data that I would never want to downgrade. So I would, my first choice would always be debug it. Figure out what the hell is wrong. Like the same thing I did with my sleep issues when I got my Mac Pro. It wasn't sleeping and it kept waking up. And like, what option do I have that I couldn't, I was going to figure out what the hell is waking it up. And by process of elimination and figuring out and disconnecting everything and connecting one device at a time and, running a bare operating system and saying, what if I have this program? But, eventually got it mostly under control because that was my only option. That's always my first choice, is to actually debug it, which is annoying and laborious, but usually can be done, or at least leads you to a conclusion that's like, I found the problem and I have no fix for it, therefore Mojave downgrade is the only option, right? But at least you'll know something about it then.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, so I'm sorry, where did we land? So would you rather me get a different go to the attic and get a different trackpad, or just eschew trackpads entirely and just go to a regular magic mouse?
I mean, I think trackpads are garbage, you should use a mouse, but either one, change that part of the equation. Like, remove all the variables, disconnect everything from your computer, find a reproducible test case that causes the problem, and then just start subtracting even more. Like, so, okay, now I can get this thing to do weird crap. Does it still do weird crap with a mouse? Does it still do weird crap with my other trackpad? Like, whatever. Just start, running experiments until you can make it misbehave and then figure out when it does and when it doesn't misbehave.
Yeah, I think get the other trackpad out of the attic, use it in Bluetooth mode, and see if you have the machine gun issue. That's step one. And then if you do, then possibly try the USB in different port kind of situation. But I would say first try it as Bluetooth. I would also, I heard, as I was frequently complaining about various Bluetooth disconnect bugs that I've been having for years on my Macs with the mouse and the trackpad, a few people have told me over the years that this can happen with 2.4 gigahertz interference, and that trying to minimize that as much as possible had a pretty good effect for them. And so this could be things like switching as much as your Wi-Fi stuff as possible over to 5.8, or especially stuff that would be in or near your office where your computer is. You could try that as well. Although, I hate to jinx anything here, and maybe I should knock on if I could find some actual wood around here. I have not had the Bluetooth mouse and trackpad random disconnection bug in a little while. I don't know. I don't remember exactly when the last time that it happened was, but it hasn't been recently. It's been probably at least a month or two. So I think they might have fixed that. Finally, after like 3 years of it being a constant problem. So I think that my bug is fixed. It's just like my music bug. Yay, I'm doing great. Sorry, Casey, you're not, but
Great.
Yeah, so anyway, so if there's anything to that, try to reduce 2.4 gigahertz radio traffic in the area and switch over to Bluetooth, so to try to test the machine gun trackpad thing to see if it still applies to the new trackpad that you should have been switching to a long time ago.
All right. I will try the trackpad first. The problem is I don't have any real, I have a bunch of anecdata, like I said earlier, on things that seem to make it worse, but I don't have anything where I can say, do this, then this, then this, then this, and bam, it happens, Yeah, it's just so frustrating.
And sleep-wake problems are the same thing. I had to wait for hours. You'd put it to sleep, and then you'd have to come back in the morning and see when it woke up and how frequently and why. And it's a tough debug cycle. But I mean, if it actually is a problem, you should be able to make it happen just by using your computer, right? If you have to, hook up your podcast microphone and just be recording all day long.
That's an interesting point. Yeah.
With your headphones on while do development work, and eventually if it starts glitching out, you'd be like, aha, and then you have to already have console open and, I don't know. It's annoying, but debugging is Debugging programs is no fun, and debugging your computer setup is also no fun. They are very similar. At least you're sitting there in front of your computer. I spent today debugging a switch glass bug on someone else's computer across the internet, which is worse.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it does not seem fun.
But through email, to be clear, not through screen sharing, which would have been so much easier. And you know, and you're just like, I need to run Xcode on your machine and step through the debugger, but that's not possible. So you just builds back and forth with print statements. It's great. Found the bug, though.
Oh, good.
Oh, good. That's exciting.
Yeah. A lot of print statements.